Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Ghoul Cast. I'm Chris Ringler, your creepy host for the moment. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to really dive into these like we used to, but we're hoping that we can kind of change that and get back onto a regular schedule again. For the time being, we thought it would be great to kind of dive into what's become kind of a tradition of the last 3 years, and that is to read some of our creepy fiction. A few of us in the Flint Horror Collective are writers, and Halloween seems to inspire us. So we're each recording these separately, so I'll put them all together. So unfortunately, we're not together for this podcast, which is kind of a drag, but hopefully we can bring you a late season shiver as the shadow of Halloween recedes and we start heading towards the holidays. So as I get going, settle in, pour something warm and bloody, and we'll see if we can creep you out a little as the days start to darken. This is a creepy little story I like to call Last House of the Night. The girl's legs felt like they were on fire. She had never gone out this far before, or for this long. She was past any neighborhood she recognized, and the bag of candy she was carrying had slowly gotten heavier and heavier until now it felt like it weighed 100 pounds. She was an hour past the point where she would be in trouble, especially on her first solo trick-or-treat trip. Especially when it wasn't even supposed to be her first night solo, but tonight was different. It was better, far better, to be alone and with someone she cared about, even if it was just yourself. Better than to be with people who were made to take you with them. Emma hadn't wanted to go out with her fake friends, though. The friends her mom had set up for her. The friends that had to take her with them because she was different. 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 She'd never hated a word so much in her life. Even at 10, she knew it well, and the sharp edges of the word offered it if you held it up to the right light. Mom and Dad used the word different so often with Emma to explain why people were strange towards her, why they wouldn't sit near her or speak to her or play with her, that she had come to look at the word the same way one looked at any other slur. She was tired of being different. She just wanted to disappear. She wanted to be part of the fun, even if she wasn't directly part of it. So she lied and said she wasn't feeling well enough to go out. And when trick-or-treating began, she was suddenly all better and had her mom and dad convinced that she was only going out to catch up with the other kids. She knew that this was a lie built on thin ice, that as soon as mom spoke to the other parents of the other kids, that her lie would be dragged out into the light. But she didn't care. She didn't. All she cared about was one night, this night, out and free and on her own with no pity, no guilt, and nothing different. She was just another ghoul in a parade of them, lost in the darkness as soon as the porch light lost its will. She never got to see other kids, being homeschooled, and the only ones she did see were friends of her parents' friends who never seemed to have fun with Emma and barely faked that they were having fun. Halloween was Emma's favorite night of all. A night when she could go out with her parents and not have to focus on being different, but could focus on having fun. This year, though, Auntie Kelly was sick in the hospital and Mom and Dad needed to be with her, so Emma was pushed onto the kids that didn't like her. She knew what would happen if she went with them. They'd ignore her and do everything they could to distance themselves until they got home, and then they'd brag about what good boys and girls they had been to take the different girl with them. Yeah, Emma could go out with those kids, but she didn't want to. She might as well stay home if that was the case. So she had lied and tricked her parents and went out on her own. And she loved it. She was having the best Halloween ever. Emma had lost track of time, though, and it was late now, after 9, and the temperature had dropped significantly. As she had noticed a group of kids with the best costumes she had ever seen, best not because they were better made or more original than anyone else's, but because they were so plain, so ordinary, and so normal that they stood out. Monster, ghost, witch, mummy, vampire, They were timeless, but so stuck within a certain time. They caught her attention when she heard a group of kids laughing as they walked past them, making fun of how old-fashioned the costumes were. She liked it, though. She was in her self-made bloody ghost costume. And she loved it. And she loved them. So she started following them. She hadn't meant to, not at first, but now that she had been following them for a half an hour, she realized that she had lost track of time and that she was now among them, part of their silent group as it pushed forward down a dirt road and towards a distant light in the woods. The tree-lined path was lit with ghoulish-looking jack-o'-lanterns as the dirt road wound deeper into the darkness and away from town. The air was cold enough that the smell of burning leaves hung heavy, and there was ground fog forming that poured out from between the trees. This must be the last house of the night. Then they'd turn around after this and head home, surely. But what if they didn't? It was when they had reached the end of the road and the beginning of the gravel driveway to the small home that she looked at her watch again and, seeing it was now past 10 at night, she started to fall back and then turned towards home and left the group behind. She felt a tug on her sheet and turned to see that the group had caught up with her. They stood silently watching her, all of them but the vampire, who held the frayed edge of the sheet in his bloodied hand, as his other hand held a full bag of candy. Emma took a step backwards and the group stepped forward with her. Another step back matched by her, another step forward. She took one more step and they didn't, and her sheet pulled taut. Her heart was racing, uncertain what they wanted. She grabbed a part of her sheet that the vampire was holding and pulled at it, and it came free of his hand. She took a step back and they didn't follow. She turned and started to quickly walk away from the other kids in the house and more questions than could fit into her head. "Please come with us," a soft voice, too soft to guess if it had been from a boy or girl. Emma turned back to the group and they all had their hands outstretched to her. "Come with us, Emma. Come with us." Inside her costume, Emma's mouth dropped open. How did they know her name? How could they know her name? The vampire boy spoke this time. "We can only ask you three times, Emma. Three times, then not again. And once we have asked the third time, if you don't come with us, that's all there is. You could follow, well, you could try, but you'd never find us. Never. We'd be gone and you'd always remember this night, this moment, and the last time we asked. Come with us. Come away from how people see you, how they treat you, and towards something better. I'm going to ask you one last time, Emma. One last time. Trust your heart. See beyond your fear and take my hand and please." The vampire took two steps forward and under the solitary light that stood guard down this dark drive, and Emma realized that its costume was old, very old, and she thought she could see beneath the mask, and that he, "Come with us." Emma noticed that when the vampire spoke, there were no puffs of air as there were when she breathed. None of the kids in the group were puffing like she was. She looked closer, and none of them were even breathing. In the distance, the light at the house they had been walking towards blinked once, twice, and a third time. The other trick-or-treaters in the group turned and began walking slowly towards the light. The vampire boy stretched his hand out to her, and it was too much. This was all too much. He was different. They were different. Too different. Too different. And that decided it for Emma. She stepped forward and took the vampire boy's cold hand. He smiled at her, and then they turned and began walking towards the house as well. The rest of the group stopped and, looking back towards them, were waiting for them. His hand was so cold, but it made her feel warm to hold it. Even when something deep in the woods howled, she could only smile because she thought that this time, just this time, different was exactly what she needed. And that's my story. I hope you enjoyed it. If you want to check out other weird stuff I write, you can check my blog, www.spookychris.com, or look back in the other archives of the Ghoulcast and track down all the other weird stuff I write. Thanks a lot.
Hello and happy Halloween. This is Lucifer Fulci, and I will be reading a bit of my book called Vile Witches for you this evening. Worm Food Horror Media presents Vile vile witches for my fiend and brother, Uncle Salem. The soul, it seems to be so endless. One existence after another, right? Only in the moments that we stop buying into distraction and take a deep look around do we find that maybe we've been here before. Same energy, different form. Long live the new flesh. Still, some things seem the same in whatever skin I am wearing. I look to the heavens, and the clouds are always there, bustling away, moving candidly within a gray sky. There are always deep, sorrowful gusts of wind that blow cracked leaves upon dead grass. There is dirt, mud, and granite that lay upon the earth. Stones of random shape and nature everywhere on endless rough terrain. Squared and oval slabs mark the ground where the dead lay. I always find my way there. Maybe a former body of mine is buried beneath the soil of the cemetery, rotting away. Wolves howl and bats fly. Strange and unnameable creatures peer about from dark corners, and the shadows remind me that there must be light in order for a darkness to appear. I am such these morbid fantasies and dark, deadly dreams. They haunt me, and I do love to be haunted. An otherworldly whisper tells me I've not long left before my wings protrude and fly me away into the dark where I might know the truth again. Until that time, I will walk in this skin, speak with this tongue, and call upon the ancient gods to help me make it through my time upon this spinning rock in the midst of time and space. Something wicked, foul, and vile, slithering creature infests. A thing unseen to the human eye burrows and devours, digests. Haunted harlot, undying and festering, discovers a virgin soul, perpetuates an ancient curse where the devil takes his toll. The day and year are lost to me. The 17th century has become like a fog that rolls down by the banks of the river. It is thick and difficult to see through in the early hours of the morning, but still I must attend to my chores. It is where I gather water for my family and wash the filth from the garments that we wear whilst working. We are distant from other families in the village, but never so far away that we cannot wave to one another and see a small smile behind a friendly shape. Such things bring comfort in a time when the darkness speaks to me in solemn, sordid secret. Although my family surrounds me, in the day I feel alone. I have always felt alone, regardless of my brothers and sisters and their seemingly endless amounts of laughter and love they have to give. They are still small and silly. For me, those years never seemed to exist. In my world, I am surrounded by an enemy that dwells in the church. My conscience tells me so, although nobody from the sanctuary has ever harmed me. It is a normal day to most, but for me, a strange day that I cannot fully explain. A feeling of sickness writhes in my guts, yet no pain is present. It is like a rock laying there, clogging my will to stand comfortably. At the same time, I cannot be still. I do not want to work today, but if I do not, Father will lash out with words and guilt. We are given a home and a small farm by the grace of God, and we must tend to it, he preaches. It is how we feed ourselves and each other. Each and every day, there are chores. And then, with no choice of her own, Cassandra drops her spade and small bag of seeds. A deep, sour breath exhales, and the thing is inside of her. It sets itself in her bones and masters their movement. It seeps towards the dark energies of her spirit and flows through like a warm wind on an autumn evening. There are no eyes upon her except for those of God, and yet it seems that even he must allow the young woman to walk with this evil and make her way to a place unknown, hidden by a spell. Moments pass, the sun begins to fade, and the very outskirts of Cassandra's home fade into the void. The voices in her head speak in twisted tongues, and a demon's eyes are her visage. The thin, pale clothing upon her porcelain skin seems to fade together, and the brisk winds of the coming night have no effect on her. Her flesh is covered with goosebumps, and the fine hairs are standing on end. With each step, she loses another memory of her life in the village with those people. Who were they again? Bugs and vermin crawl up and down her bare legs, and some tiny things begin to make a nest in her thick, dark hair. Still, she moves with no rest and travels long and far. A lone bell tolls beyond the mist. Darkness dwells in and around the forest, and to the common eye there is nothing more than the thick blanket of trees that protrude from the smoky cover. The sounds of crows fade in and out, while the lure of the sacred forbidden grounds persists in Cassandra's entranced heart. Mesmerized, she continues to move toward the coven. Engulfed in the haze of night, the fog whisks about her flesh, like some dancing spirit beckoning her for a slow, sweet dance. It holds her closer. She feels the grasp of an unholy alliance pulling her deep in the forbidden hills. Like being born again into blasphemy, she penetrates the veil and takes her first step onto the grounds where the devil dwells. The foul thing plays cruelly with several of its daughters, always under hypnotic will and lustful intent. Excited, Cassandra stands before a scene from hell. It is a world unto itself, and cannot be seen or heard on this unholy night. Molly is there, captivating and cursed, her red locks curling and swaying in a damp wind that circles around the dark and secret arena. Her eyes glow red and her smile delirious. A fire burns before her, and the smoke slowly reveals her sisters. They are triplets, each with dirty, dark hair that reveal their breasts. They are barely clad in thin, flowing gowns. A stink whips around the wind. The stale breeze reveals scars and filth upon their skin. The grime is deep and dark, plastered on their shaking bodies. The rank of their unclean flesh draws Cassandra closer. Molly takes her by the hand and pulls her into a circle. Their eyes gaze upon one another. Without words, they read into each other's energy. There is a bloodlust, a sinful calling to them. Each one of them smiles and begins to laugh to one another. A thunderous boom cracks the sky and sings a sweet symphony of blasphemy down upon their dance. Bare feet bounce about as they cackle and shift, their skin turning gray, then black, and back again. The youthful skin of Cassandra ages along with her coven, all writhing in an ecstasy brought about by the anxious notion of murder. The burning wood of the fire cracks, and Molly looks to the shadows beyond. It is there she sees the infant. Waking from his innocent slumber, and unaware of his short life, he is called upon for the ritual. He lays in an old blanket and begins to cry. An illumination appears from beyond the dead trees and shines through. It reveals a skeleton laid upon the ground, cradling the small human.
"Destroy the thing," shouts one of the triplets. "We are mother, daughter, and unholy ghost," another yells.
Grunts and laughter mix with cries, and the circle breaks. Dancing turns to uneasiness as they await the warm, sweet blood of the infant. Lost inside Cassandra is her soul, not quite dead, but hiding in the heat of this unholy moment.
"Kill the pig!"
they scream and become wild and impatient.
"His blood will be ours,"
Molly responds.
"We will awaken the father of lies, the father of pain, lord of despair and destruction."
A bloody sap begins to expel from the limbs of the dead trees. It has a scent of rotten, dead flesh, then sulfur, and then a copper stench that fills their nostrils. The dirt breaks open and hundreds of twitching, scurrying insects and slugs begin to find their way towards their sweaty, stinking skin. And there, my children of the night, my wonderful, beautiful ghouls and goblins, you have 15 minutes into Vile Witches by Lucifer Fulci. If you are at all interested in hearing the rest of the story, feel free to seek this book out upon the immortal internet. Or you can always go to luciferfulci.com. That's Lucifer, F-U-L-C-I.com, and order directly from there. I can tell you this, it doesn't have a happy ending. All the same, I wish you all well and a happy Halloween. Now and each day forward, for Samhain is never over.
Ooh. Hi, I'm Paul Canellis. I'm recording this from inside my home haunt, and so it's kind of spooky for me, but this is a revision of a story that I wrote. You may hear the occasional wind and flapping of tarp, but this is called Bob Zombie, a love story. The chicken. That frickin' chicken. Bob Hinojosa Jr. sat on the toilet at Baba's Chicken Shake restaurant, dreading his return to his shift. His stomach hurt, and the smell of that chicken was wafting through the thick air, even now, the smell of his own fresh waste notwithstanding. Bob shook his head and pulled up his tan Dockers, which were about two sizes too large for him. He tucked in his fugly puke-poo-green chicken store shirt, Blaine had called it that in jest earlier in the day, and sighed as he flushed. As he watched his feces fade into sewer heaven, he wondered if his dreams and hopes were suffering that same fate, albeit infinitely more slowly. His dreams of making it as a rapper seemed as unlikely to come true as hanging with William Shatner at a rave. Bob had a habit of being too critical of himself. He paused at the mirror, studying the lines on his pale face, wondering how many of them were new. With his short brownish red hair cropped close to his scalp, he reminded himself more of a hip-hop howdy-doody than the rhyme god he yearned to be. In school, he had to deal with taunts due to his white skin and Hispanic last name. They had called him White Perez, Caucasian Rodriguez, things like that. Brought back to reality by a loud bang on the door and the curse-infested prodding of an impatient night shift manager, Bob combed his hair, which was probably too short to comb, and turned quickly to hurry back to Hell's Kitchen. Blaine had come up with that gem as well. Bob didn't notice the small trail of urine directly on the floor in front of him. When the doorbell rang, no one heard it. That's because the fellas were busy yelling and screaming out Yo Mama jokes at the top of their lungs, frantically trying to top one another in a battle of the mostly regurgitated. Blaine was standing on a table. King Kong ain't got nothing on your mama. His brown yellow hair whipped around his face like an uneasy frame. He smiled broadly as the rest of them laughed. He was Bob's best friend, standing up for him regardless of Bob's guilt or the accuracy of the attack. Chris was laughing so hard it seemed as if he were almost insane. Maybe he was. He had curly light brown hair near shoulder length and abundance of freckles peppered across his nose and cheeks. That's so stupid. I have no idea why I'm laughing. Jesse looked embarrassed, a shroud of dark pink covering his boyish face. He pointed at Jason, rolling with unbridled laughter in the corner of the room. What is Jason laughing at, looking like the lost Ramon? Dorky Ramon! Jess was bald with a thick mustache that he dyed as black as he could purposely to be funny. Jason kind of did look like one of the Ramones. Hey, at least I don't look like a mix of Harry Potter and Mr. Cotter. Chris fell on the floor again. He was crying now. Ha ha! Who the heck is Mr. Cotter? The doorbell rang again. This time they heard it, except Jason, who yelled obnoxiously, Your mom's cooking is so bad, the flies pitched in to get the screen door fixed. Scattered chuckles tailed off as Blaine looked out the window. It's the police, Blaine screeched quietly. Jesse went to answer the door. The first officer, Drinkwine, took off his hat. Jesse had seen enough movies to know that the next words from the policeman's lips weren't going to be flowers and candy. Is this the residence of Bob Hinojosa? Yes. The officer sighed. His resemblance to pro wrestler Bill Goldberg notwithstanding, his eyes looked compassionate as he spoke the inevitable. I'm sorry. Bob's dead. Blaine screamed at the top of his lungs, empowered by the passion of his mourning. No! The funeral was beautiful. Rappers and rockers from around the city came to pay respects and comfort the young group. Bob was buried with his microphone, having always been enamored with the idea of Bela Lugosi spending the afterlife in his Dracula cape. Blaine didn't go. Hours after the funeral, he still lay motionless in his room, his mind racing around the week's events, refusing to settle even for a moment. After what seemed like a lifetime of silence, he screamed what many who heard it would later recall as the most blood-curdling, hair-raising shriek they'd ever heard from another human being. Then he lay motionless again, not crying, not convulsing with anger and sadness, perfectly and wholly still. Sunset Hill Cemetery was extremely quiet. There was nary a sound in the air, and the freshly covered grave of Bob Inahosa Jr. stood out in the autumn moonlight amongst the more weathered and less prominent plots nearby. Had anyone been watching in the graveyard at the late hour, something else would have caught their attention. Had anyone been watching and listening, they would have seen a faint movement above ground and heard a rustling neath the earth of Bob Inahosa Jr.'s memorial. Had anyone been watching and listening, they would have been very startled to see the hand of Bob Inahosa Jr. strike out from the ground it had been buried in. With the quietest of breaths, Bob pulled himself up from his new resting place, staggered to his feet, and began the unlikely task of walking. Resembling a newborn calf crossed with the character Bub from the film Day of the Dead, the newly revived undead rapper began the trek back to his home. Instinctively, it would seem, driven by a ringing in his ears, which, had he been able to, Bob would have recognized as the cry of his earthly best friend. At exactly 2:37 a.m., at the residence of Blaine Diffenderfer and friends, there was a very loud yet sluggish knock on the front door. Chris awoke. He gathered himself in his Scooby-Doo pajamas. "Holy crap! Calm down! I'm coming!" Chris hollered. He opened the door. To his surprise, there stood his dead friend Bob, looking a bit worse for wear, in the flesh, kind of, with a slightly goofy smile upon his mildly askew face. Chris froze. Then, he screamed what many who heard it would later recall as the second most blood-curdling, hair-raising shriek they'd ever heard from another human being. At precisely 2:39 a.m. on October 31st, the rest of the boys were awake and running into the living room. One by one, they saw Bob and reacted loudly with various forms of the phrase, "What the?" Jesse tried to hug him. Bob embraced him warmly, dumb smile ever present, but when he leaned in a little to take a nibble on Jesse's left ear, it was decided that they should refrain from further such greetings until they could assess the situation a bit more. Or as Chris put it slightly more bluntly, "Dude, he's a freaking zombie. Do not touch him." It appeared that whatever a zombie is, Bob was indeed a new member of that community. Still, zombie or no, he was a friend, and Blaine was so overjoyed to see him that the small fact that his lifelong friend had somehow crawled out from his own grave was but a footnote to their reunion. As days went by, Bob and his friends began adjusting, as it were, to the strange new situation. They had discovered that Bob's desire for flesh could be placated by raw hamburger, or sometimes even just a glazed donut with red sprinkles. Still, there were times when Bob would forget and would absentmindedly begin to gnaw on a buddy's shoulder. For these regrettable moments, the guys had zombie-fighting weapons such as a fly swatter, a rolled newspaper, a litter box scooper. They would smack him derisively, and he would look hurt for a moment but soon return to the ever-present silly smile countenance. Other activities presented new challenges. In order to integrate Bob back into everyday life, the fellows accompanied him to the bar to play with his rap group. On stage, it was instantly clear that whatever rapping skill Bob had possessed in life had been drastically reduced as a member of the undead. The audience would fidget uncomfortably, some feigning amusement as Bob labored to connect syllables and sounds. Still, the scattered applause seemed to be enough to appease him, so every Thursday night he continued his new career as the Earth's only living dead rapper. Bob also took part in pickup football games with his buddies. Blaine insisted they let him play, despite Jason's vehement feeling that it was a terrible idea. Jason's fears were realized when, during a particularly rough game, Bob was tackled and landed right in the middle of a bush. Everyone had cringed when he fell, some even relieved themselves of their respective lunch when they looked back at him. Protruding from his chest was a large, strong branch. Still, he smiled that ridiculous smile back at them. Herbert Pleasance had been hunting zombies for the last 2 years. During that time period, he had caught exactly zero. Despite his lack of productivity, he grew only more intense with his efforts. He had seen zombies before, sure, houses full of them. He had given chase to them, had run from them, and had even called some on the phone, which they answered reflexively with groans and strange sounds. Herbert hadn't shaved in at least a year. Just because the rest of the world wasn't aware of the undead walking amongst them, didn't mean he was going to take a day off from his resolve, not even to attend to personal hygiene. One fateful Thursday evening, as Bob and Jesse prepared to drive to the bar for Bob's weekly jam night escapades, Jesse would be driving, Blaine entered the house with a disturbed look on his face. "What's the deal?" asked Jesse, alarmed. "Rank von Blumpf," asked Bob, with a frivolous grin. Blaine answered, "I don't know. I just have a bad feeling, like we shouldn't go tonight." "Women's intuition," opined Chris. "Very funny," Blaine answered. "I'm serious. I feel like something bad might happen tonight." That was all Jason needed to hear. "Then we shouldn't go," he offered. Chris was having none of it. "There are five of us, and one of us is a freaking zombie. I think we'll be okay." "I'm worried about Bob. I won't. I can't lose him again," Blaine responded. "Look," started Chris, "if we get there and the vibe's still bad, we'll leave." Everyone agreed, and the fateful night began to unfold. As these things go, and as fate would have it, Herbert Pleasance was stopping by the local bar for a drink at approximately the exact moment that Bob was taking the stage. He paused in his truck with his hand on his keys upon hearing the strains of the funky beat inside the bar. "I hate rap," Herbert sighed, then decided to go in anyway. At the bar, Herbert seated himself facing away from the stage. He sipped his drink, stopping here and again to grit his teeth at the sounds emanating from the stage. As Bob began his 12-bar section of the rap song, Herbert couldn't help but to look and see what was making that awful noise. There's a moment in many fine films, and terrible films, in which the camera zooms in on a character's sudden contemplation of realization. Had this been a movie, this would have been one of those moments, and Herbert's face would have been frozen on celluloid with a jaw-dropping stare at what he was seeing. His mouth still full of crumbs, he slowly and quietly formed the word. "Zombie," he managed. He got a little louder this time. The guy next to him heard him. "Zombie." Herbert jumped to his feet, threw back his coat, grabbed the gun from his belt, and charged the stage. "Zombie!" "Oh no," yelled Jesse. "Stop him!" "No," hollered Blaine. The music stopped. Bob looked at his friends now knocking over tables to defend him from the crazed Herbert. "Gruffelgum," Bob said, with a witless smirk. Herbert roared, "Out of the way! That guy is a zombie!" Most of the patrons ran from the bar screaming, except for Bob's friends who made a human wall around him, and the brave doorman who was trying to reason with the zombie hunter. "He's not a zombie, sir. He's a rapper. Granted, he isn't very good, but that's no reason to shoot him." Herbert wouldn't be persuaded. "Zombie," he said. "He has to die. Again. "Look," said the doorman, "even if he is a zombie, he isn't hurting anyone." "Yeah, you freaking jerk," screamed Chris. Bob smiled gaily. The man appeared to be slightly calmer for a moment as he studied Bob. Something in the innocent look of his drooping yellow zombie eyes seemed to reach him. But zombies, they're bad." Jesse interjected. "Mister, Bob isn't bad. He's a tortured and unfortunate soul, but he doesn't hurt anyone. We've trained him. He doesn't want to eat flesh anymore." The doorman's eyes widened at those words. Jesse continued, "He doesn't even really know what he's doing. He has some awareness, but I think he's just acting on instinct." Herbert lowered the gun. "Well, I'll need to study him." "Study him," yelled Jason. "You should be lucky we don't call the cops on you." Blaine stepped directly in front of Herbert. "No, it's okay," he said, motioning toward Jason. "We'll let you watch him for a couple of days. After that, though, you gotta leave him alone. Let him get on with life." Herbert Pleasance began to like Bob Inahosa Jr., the zombie with the spirited smile. He watched from the couch as the young men played charades. The only problem with the game was Bob would always describe the same thing. One word, two syllables, and it was chicken. But it was fun to watch him try. And everyone laughed uproariously as Bob clucked and moved his arms back and forth at his side passionately. Weeks went by and Herbert continued his visits. Herbert was noticeably happier than before. He didn't stress about undead creatures any longer. Now he would walk into the house and say, "Hello there, Bob." Bob even began to wave at him. It seemed as if Bob was growing, ever so slightly, with awareness. He seemed more able to understand what was going on around him. He even cried during chick flicks. One night while Herbert wasn't there, the boys were sitting around the living room talking. Suddenly, Bob let out a strange yell and pointed at the TV. Michael Jackson was dancing around a graveyard to the barely audible strains of his song, Thriller. "What's wrong, Bob?" asked Blaine. Bob stood up and walked to the TV. He whimpered as he studied the emanating images. Tears rolled down his cheek. He hugged the screen. Chris laughed insanely. The next day, Blaine called Herbert. He told him about the way Bob reacted to the music video. He noted that Bob had become more vulnerable and had even openly wept at a movie night screening of the film You've Got Mail. "Hmm," said Herbert. "Maybe he's lonely." Blaine thought about that statement. "That could be it. He sees us leave on dates and he's been watching movies on the Lifetime channel." "Well, listen, I have an idea," Herbert said. Herbert remembered recently seeing a female zombie under the bridge near the woods by his house. He had called to her as calmly as his newfound zombie sympathizing would allow, but she just turned and ran. He told Blaine about the reanimated woman. "Wow. Are you sure she's a zombie?" Blaine asked excitedly. "Well, let's see. She moves slowly, drags her legs, doesn't say real words, and eats raw meat from the dumpster," Herbert replied. Blaine was still a bit skeptical. "Yeah, but a lot of people do weird things. That doesn't mean they're zombies." "Well, and also she's green," said Herbert. The next day, Herbert and the fellows drove Bob to the woods. They waited for hours at a picnic table outside the house, watching the bridge for signs of Bob's potential mate. After what seemed like hours, and halfway through the third film in the Wishmaster film marathon, courtesy of Herbert's rechargeable portable DVD player, she appeared. Bob noticed her first and said to Blaine, "Befrigidy!" Blaine tried to quiet him. She looked back toward the group of boys, then started to run away. Blaine called after her, "Don't be afraid." She stopped and looked again. Bob began walking toward her. This time, she didn't run. "Dude, this is so crazy," said Chris. Jesse laughed, wiping away a tear. When Bob reached the girl, they studied each other for a moment. Bob smiled inanely. The girl returned the goofy gaze. "Get a room," yelled Chris. Under the bridge at sunset, two zombies embraced and began walking back slowly toward the group. It took quite some time because they were arm in arm and having a harder time moving at any kind of quick pace. "This is the weirdest thing I've ever seen," said Jesse. "But somehow it's beautiful." And it was. The undead couple reached the boys, who hugged Bob and introduced themselves to the girl. The sun was now nearly set, and the moon was illuminating the huge yard. Bob looked so happy. He turned to look at his new mate, then turned to Blaine and gave him a huge hug. Then, in a moment of inspired quickness, Bob grabbed Chris and bit his left pinky off. The rest of the boys screamed and ran, and Herbert hurried to his truck to get his gun. Happy Halloween.
One last time, we thank you so much for tuning in this time and checking out the Ghoulcast. It is always a pleasure to bring a little weirdness. This was our chance to tell some of our weird little stories. Usually we're chatting up a storm about movies and books and music and all kinds of weird horror stuff. So make sure to check us out. You can find our podcast wherever you found this one, or you can check the whole archive on www.flinthorrorcon.com. We have a special page set up there that has the whole archive of all of our shows that we've done. Thanks again, and have a creepy morning, noon, or night.